Welcome to the Sounds of Success, brought to you by the National Association of Professional Martial Artists. This audio magazine is a tool for generating profitable ideas and for taking your business to new levels of excellence and performance. Here you'll find real-life case studies of school owners just like you who have applied our proven successful business and marketing principles to their school and are creating the business of their dreams as a result.
We actually sort of have an extended audience today. You know, we kind of wanted to fill everybody in on that. Obviously, members on the line today, and we also have some other special guests on the line, part of our upper level NAPMA, and they're going to be those for a lot of our coaching clients and a lot of our other in the industry in the expansion of Mile High Karate through the U.S. We kind of have a little bit of an eclectic audience today, but which obviously for those who don't know, I'm a regional developer for Mile High Karate, and I'm also acting as the vice president of marketing for NAPMA. We've been really experiencing a tremendous growth curve, not just only with Mile High Karate, but with the organization in general, with the acquisition of NAPMA and with the expanding martial arts industry, and frankly, healing some old wounds that really needed to be healed. And it's a very exciting process. And one of the things that we wanted to accomplish is get up to speed on where we're at with things and what your role in that is and what NAPMA's role in that's going to be. We kind of have a special extended long we go 90 minutes, you know, or more. And we're going to have a lot of really important nuts and bolts about a black belt school with great quality students. Background information on Master Smith as well. So, so much for being on the call with us today. I really appreciate your time.
Oh, my pleasure.
Obviously, your background as a competitor and as a former world champion. You know, I'm only just maybe, you know, one more than you. So, you know, you were in a little generation cycle, competition career, and there might be people like me out there who might be younger than you are that might not know what you were able to accomplish in your career. Can you recap that for us real quickly?
Well, my competition career began in actually 19... what year were you born, Toby?
A little while after that.
Okay.
Seven.
But, you know. Okay. Well, anyway, the career started, and I started in Texas, satellite schools for Jun Rhee. You know, grandma, the first person to teach Taekwondo in America, and he started back in 1956 in actually San Marcos, Texas, and then he came back and transferred to the University of Texas, and when he was in Texas, he started his martial arts training, and that's how I got involved, through one of his black belts from my hometown in Kingsville, and eventually I became instructor there at Texas A&I University, which is now Texas A&M University. It's one of their satellite universities in Kingsville. And in 1970, Jun Rhee, when he would come down every 3 months during the 60s each semester and do the testing for our students so we could get our students in black belt certified under Grandmaster Rhee. And when he came down in 1970, he asked me to come to Washington, D.C. and to teach for him. And that's really when my career, now I was winning a lot of the tournaments in Texas, and there were some big tournaments in Texas. You know, they had the U.S. Championships in Dallas, Alan Steen's tournament. And I took second in that one before, but I really hadn't blossomed my martial arts competition career till I came out to Washington, D.C. And once I made martial arts my career, I really got into heavy training at that time, and just started going to every tournament every weekend. I mean, we were flying all over the country so we could get in a tournament almost every single weekend. And, of course, during that time, I eventually became the number one point fighter in the country, along with Bill Wallace and Howard Jackson. Professional Karate Magazine had us rated 1, 2, and 3. And one year I was 1, Bill was 2, and Howard was 3. Another year Bill was 1, I was 2, and Howard was 3. Another year Howard was number 1, Bill was 2, and I was 3. So we kind of went back and forth, the three of us. We were winning most of the tournaments back then, all the major tournaments. And then in 1974, that's when the full contact started. And once the full contact started, the people that were number 1, they had 4 weight classes at that time. They had a lightweight division, a middleweight, a light heavy, and a heavyweight. And in the rankings, they had me ranked the number 1 light heavyweight. They had Bill Wallace ranked the number 1 middleweight, Howard Jackson the number 1 lightweight, and Joe Lewis the number 1 heavyweight. Since we had a ranking system in those weight classes, when they had the first world championships in Los Angeles on the wide world of entertainment, they had a special Sunday evening show on national TV to highlight the first world championships in professional full contact karate. And when they did that, the U.S. already had their seed, so they just let those guys. The other countries ran competitions and established champions in their weight classes. And then when we came to the event, each of the countries sent over their representatives, and that's how we eliminated down to the final world championship. I ended up fighting for the world championship, Wally Slokey from Canada, who was also one of the top fighters back then, and still a legend in Canada, and you know, probably one of the best fighters along with Jean-Yves Thériault to come out of Canada. But that's how the full contact career started, and that was my beginning of my full contact and kickboxing. After that, in 1974, I held the world title for 7 years up to 1980. And some of those competitions that I had, defending my world championship, it was a rematch. One of my first matches was a rematch for Wally Slokey to give him a chance to get another crack at the title since he lost it in the first world championships. And that was at the Battle of Atlanta. That was at the finals at Joe Corley's back in 1975 or 76. You know, as you get older, you know you're getting old when the years start blending together. But that was an important tournament, important fight, because that was also aired on the Champions TV series. And got a lot of national publicity for TV. Another one of my memorable fights was the Thrilla from Manila when Muhammad Ali fought Joe Frazier. That was their third fight, and most people say that one of the greatest. And it was on closed circuit TV, and 50 million people were watching that fight. And I fought on that card against Kareem Allah, who was one of Don King's fighters out in New York. And that was for the heavyweight title, for Don King's title. But I was the light heavyweight world champion, so I actually had to go up a weight class. So they actually made it as a, you know, two champions, the light heavyweight versus the heavyweight. And Joe Lewis was actually supposed to fight him in that title fight, but he had lost his title to a young Ross Scott, who was one of Glenn Keeney's black belts out of Indiana. And but nobody had heard of him, and he was young and didn't have a big record, even though he went on for quite a few years and was a good, very good champion. But at that time, nobody really knew him too much. He didn't have much of a reputation, so Don King didn't want to use him. And since I had been number one in the country for a number of years and had a little more recognition, then he asked me if I would be willing to fight him. And I was about 175 pounds then, and I think he was about 215, 220 then, and had a little reach on me. He was about 6'3", and I was 5'11". But I won a unanimous decision on that fight with Don King's judges, which is not an easy thing to do.
Yeah, no small task, yeah.
But it was broadcast to 50 million people, and I believe it still holds the record for the largest viewing audience of any martial arts event. And so those were, you know, along with the first world championship, of course, I would have to say would be the most memorable, you know, being the very first time they ever did anything like that. And then the Muhammad Ali fighting on that undercard, that was exciting for me too.
Sure. And Grandmaster Smith, you've been able to accomplish some things that have been a real struggle for many, many, many professional martial artists. You've been able to translate success in the ring or success on the mat, success as a competitor, over to the business arena and success as a school owner. And definitely we want to talk a little bit about that in a few minutes here. You know, one of the things that we always teach our students on the mat is that all of the skills that they're learning in class about how to set a goal, how to accomplish the goal, how to overcome obstacles along the way, that they can apply those things in life. Yet it's still sometimes amazing to us, especially with the NATMA audience, being able to interact with so many martial arts school operators. It's sometimes amazing that they don't apply that principle in their own life, where they train to be they train and they're very dedicated in their physical training and they're very dedicated in their mental training in the style of their art, but then think that the business side of things will take care of itself. You know, we see that so many times, and you've made an amazing transformation in that, and been able to apply those principles in both arenas. And you know, one of the things that we talk about a lot is surrounding yourself with other people who are successful, surrounding yourself with other people who are better than you are, who are as good as you are at what you want to do. How valuable that can be. And I know that you've trained with some of the top martial artists in history. Tell us a little bit about that. Who have been, you know, some of the people that you contribute, you know, some of your physical technique success with being able to train with some of these, you know, top competitors and top martial artists. Who were some of the people that are the most, you know, notable in your mind?
Well, you know, there were fighters in Texas before I came out that I trained with before I had any notoriety. Carlton Morris and Johnny Woolley. Now, these were two unheralded fighters back then. Johnny Woolley went on to fight Joe Louis for one of June Ree's 1965 Nationals, and he was a lightweight. He weighed about 135, 140 pounds, and, you know, Joe Louis was a powerhouse, and he only beat Johnny back then they had half points. He beat him by a half point. It was like 24 to 23 and a half or something like that, and so he had a major influence because he's the one that got me started. He was from my hometown, but that was the person that was a little bit unknown back then. You know, he graduated from the University of Texas. We went to high school together. We graduated from high school together. He went on to University of Texas and graduated with a law degree, and now is one of the richest men in Texas. He owns all the Slosky franchises all over the country, the sandwich shops. But he also developed the area around Austin, Lake Austin, all out through there. He also bought a major part of downtown Austin and renovated it and brought the city back and developed the city. And now he's on to other things that he's been doing. So he's a very important part of my reason for being in the martial arts, along with Grandmaster Ree, who would come down and give us those tests and gave me the opportunity to come to Washington, D.C. So those would be the two that I would start off with the most credit. You know, one of my first competitors that I competed against, Pat Worley, he really was a good friend of mine and helped me, you know, my first big national tournament that was the U.S. Championships in Dallas, and I was fighting him for the championship as a brown belt, and he beat me. I ended up taking second place. He took first, and inspired me to work out more. And he was a great kicker then, and a good puncher. And so when I came to Washington, D.C., the first person that I asked Jun Lee if I could bring Pat Worley from Texas to come up and teach for him also. And he was from the Fort Worth area, one of Pat Burleson's Chuck Levin black belts through that system, which was also the Jun Lee system under Alan Steen. And Pat Worley came up to Washington, D.C. When he came, he brought his brother, John Worley. And then John brought Gary Hestelow, who later, along with Larry Carnahan, Gary brought Larry Carnahan. So we started bringing all these guys, we called them transplants. We had the hard, rough and tumble Texas fighters coming up to the East Coast, meeting and merging with all the technicians, because they had quite a bit of flashy technique up on the East Coast. And when you combine that with the hard style Texas fighting, it produced a very good quality student. So we were able to generate, you know, at one time we had either the world champion or the number one contender in every weight class in kickboxing in the country coming out of Washington, D.C. from our schools. But these were some of the people that when I first came up to Washington, D.C., they helped build the Jun Lee Institute and expand the Jun Lee Institute. John and Pat Worley and Gary Hestelow and Larry Carnahan later moved to Minneapolis, Minnesota, along with Gordon Franks, who was from Washington, D.C., one of Pat Worley's black belts. And Pat Worley, when he moved to Minneapolis with Larry and John and Gary and all them, they formed a partnership and expanded to the Diamond Nationals, and then they had their national karate schools and USA Karate and expanded and still have a lot of schools up in that area. Of course, Larry Carnahan is now the president of NASCA and still running schools there in Minneapolis with John Worley, and Pat Worley still there running schools with Gordon Franks. But Gordon Franks was the first super lightweight world champion. So these were all people that I had trained with in Washington, D.C., and they went out to other parts of the country. Of course, another one of those people was Stephen Oliver, who we brought up from Oklahoma, again, from one of the Jun Lee satellite schools, and he was an up-and-coming brown belt with, you know, real flashy kicks. He kicked like Bill Wallace, you know, with his kicks straight up in the air with super flexibility and could fight. So he came up as a brown belt. I invited him to come to Washington, D.C. and train with us. So he came up and stayed one summer and trained and liked it up there. And when he got his black belt and decided he wanted to come up to Washington, D.C. and get his graduate degree from Georgetown. And that's how Steve became part of the Jun Lee organization. And, of course, even back then, besides his fighting, he still had that great business mind even back then when he was helping run the Jun Lee organization. And then as John and Pat and those guys went and opened their schools up in Minneapolis, then eventually Steve moved out to Denver and opened his schools out there and started expanding. And now, as you know, Mile High is the premier franchise martial arts schools in the country with Master Oliver, the head of the organization. So those were some of the people that had impact in the martial arts community. There were other guys who were top fighters who fought on our U.S. team, our Washington, D.C. team. We went to all the national tournaments. We had beaten Chuck Norris's team. We had beaten the big Texas team, Alan Steen's team from Texas. We had beaten teams from all over the country, in from the southeast and the northwest and the northeast, and we were just traveling all over Canada, Mexico, and our Washington D.C. team back then. We had as a super lightweight was Otis Hooper and Gordon Franks. We had as our middleweight we had Floyd Jackson. Who was one of the top middleweights back then, and Rodney Batiste, who became a PKA U.S. champion and WKA world champion in kickboxing. He fought Jean Yves, and Jean Yves, one of Jean Yves' first title defenses, and went the distance with him. One of the few guys to go the distance was Jean Yves Thériault from Canada. And in the lightweight division, we also had Michael Coles, who was a U.S. champion and the number one contender in the lightweight division in kickboxing. And Otis and Gordon were both super lightweights. I don't know if I call them lightweights. They were actually both super lightweights. Mike was the lightweight. So that's when Gordon was the world champion, and Otis was one of the top. And then in the lightweight division, we had Michael Coles, who was the number one contender and the U.S. champion. And then in the middleweight, we had Rodney Batiste, who was the U.S. champion and the number one contender. And then in light heavyweight, I was the world champion. We also had Wayne Van Buren, who was another light heavyweight that fought on our team and fought as a heavyweight. We would switch back and forth because we really didn't have a real heavyweight, so him and I would switch back and forth on some of those weight classes. I'd fight heavy one time and he'd fight light heavy and vice versa in the team fighting. But those were some of the guys that trained out of my school. Now, there were other guys that that we worked out with and that were from our Washington, D.C. area. George Thanos, who was from Kiwon Kim School, and Neil Ehrlich, and Michael Warren, and Albert Cheeks, and Mitchell Barbro, and all these guys were from Kiwon Kim School in Silver Spring, Maryland, which was right outside of D.C., and they were our major competition, but we also got along very well and trained together from time to time. And so we had a unique opportunity to work with some of those guys. There was also some other groups in the Washington, D.C. area. There was Furman Marshall and Jose Jones. And Jose Jones had a group of black belts, and Jose was one of the junior black belts and had his own group in the inner city. Called the Wheel Kickers, and then Furman Marshall had his school in D.C. And in Baltimore, there was Arnold Mitchell and Riley Hawkins had a school. So between those guys, we were winning, you know, out of those people that I just said, we were winning all of the tournaments pretty much up and down the East Coast, even up into New York City. So those were, you know, when you got up to New York City, then you had Joe Hayes and Adolfo Velasco was one of the forum competitors. You had Louis Delgado, and there was a bunch of other guys out of the Tong Dojo with a bunch of their top guys. So back then, it was a great day. Down in the South, Joe Corley had his group of competitors and team that he would take all over, and Mike Foster down in Florida had his group. So there was some great fighters back in Texas, and through that group was Alan Steen, along with Fred Wren and Demetrius Havanas, and they had a whole bunch of top fighters, Skipper Mullins, and guys that came up through that Texas system. You know, California had all the Chuck Norris guys with Howard Jackson and Bob and Ralph Alegria and Darnell Garcia and Benny the Jet. And, you know, they had all their top fighters that were competing back then. And Saunders was there, too. I mean, there was just so many top competitors. And then when you went up into the Northeast, you had Dan Anderson and Steve Armstrong's group had a bunch of top fighters up in that area. it was quite interesting to travel all over. And when you went over to the Midwest, you had Ken Knutson, and he had a big group with Steve Kajewski and a whole bunch of other guys. And Glenn Keeney had his group. So that pretty much, St. Louis, Mike Anderson started his group there, and Mike Anderson was one of the real pioneers. Without him and Joe Louis, we would have never started the Full Contact, because they're the ones that put on the first world championships. And Mike Anderson had started some schools in St. Louis with Fred Wren, and had a great program and a great system going back then in the 70s. And Mike Anderson is still involved in the martial arts now, and is involved with the WACO, and is one of the real pioneers in getting the martial arts spread all throughout Europe. And he's living down in Florida now. Of course, you have Bill Wallace and Joe Louis, and they were kind of all over the country, because Bill was up in Indiana, then he was down in the South there, and in Memphis, and then he was out in California, and now he's down in Florida, and Joe was in California, and then went to North Carolina, and then now he's down in Florida. So they were kind of all over the place. So, you had those top guys too, and I got to train with both of them, and they were really the top pioneers, along with Howard Jackson and Benny the Jet. Those were, out of the original fighters, those were probably the most recognized competitors that pretty much dominated all the tournaments with on a national level. You would always see a Joe Louis name, or a Bill Wallace name, or a Howard Jackson name, or a Benny the Jet name, and those were the guys that that won just about every tournament back then.
It certainly, bodes for the argument that we make consistently with martial arts school operators, is that, the people that you choose to surround yourself with in most part will determine where you'll end up. And had you been isolated in some corner of the country and never left, and just been in your school kind of training day to day, you probably never would have accomplished the level of performance and the level of accomplishment that you did in the competitive arena, had you not been surrounded by guys like, Joe Louis and Bill Wallace and Benny the Jet and Howard Jackson, right? I mean, that's just a no-brainer. So, I mean that I think that's a perfect lesson for a school owner to take away from the phone call today, is, had you been isolated in an island unto yourself, you maybe would have accomplished X, But since you were surrounded by such a supportive environment of competitors who were pushing you to do your best, you accomplished X times 10. So I think that's a perfect takeaway if I'm a school owner listening in on the call.
Exactly. You cannot always have everybody come to your school and do the training, even though now, back then, there weren't too many people traveling around doing seminars like there are now. Nowadays, you actually can get a Bill Wallace or a Joe Louis or people to come do a seminar. You now have the NATMA, who is helping schools all over the country, where we didn't have any of that back then. The only help we got is when we shared it among each others. And some of the pioneers back then in the early days was Pat Johnson and Chuck Norris and Joe Louis. They were operating some of the best schools in California. And then in the South, in Texas, there was Alan Steen and Pat Burleson and George Minshew in Houston, Texas. These guys were the business guys and that ran schools. And then in the East was June Rhee, and in the South was Joe Corley, and then in Florida was Bill Clark. And those guys, we had a tight group amongst us, and we actually shared information. And then what happened, each of us had another circle of friends that we would share the information with, and they had circles of friends, and that's how it got around, probably slower than snail mail, whereas now with the internet and all the availability, the school owners are very fortunate to be able to accomplish so much if they keep their ears and eyes open and use their motivation to seek the knowledge, because back then we had to travel far and wide to seek the knowledge. And we just didn't, even in Washington, D.C., we didn't just stay in Washington, D.C. We went all over the country. And when we were trying business things, we were sharing knowledge with that group that I was telling you about in the different parts of the country to see what was working for them. So through trial and error, all of those people came up with a real hybrid system that they passed on to the next generation that passed on. And that's how Stephen Oliver and Pat Worley and John Worley and Larry Carnahan and Gordon Frankson, all those guys were able to run, and Joe Corley and Bill Clark and Alan Steen and Pat Burleson and Chuck Norris and Pat Johnson and Joe Lewis had run those successful schools back then. And Bob Wall was another one. I mean, there was a lot of guys that were doing things like that in that time era.
It's certainly not as robust of a support infrastructure as we have today, but it's the same process. You know, again,
it pales in comparison. It's amazing how much is available. And you know, for some school owners, it's almost like eating with the golden spoon. They get a little spoiled. There's so much information out there that sometimes they don't take it and put it into action because they get a little overwhelmed, rather than taking a few things and implement. The key to success is first get the knowledge, but you got to, once you get the car, you got to put the key in and start it. And if you don't start it, if you don't implement, if you don't put some of this stuff that you're looking at, and you don't have to, a lot of guys try to wait to put it all into action at the same time. You don't. You just start with one thing and get that going and then start the next thing. And if you do that, then you're going to benefit tremendously from all of the NAPMA monthly packet information and all of the different phases that they have. And now they have so many different, not just the basic package, but for the sophisticated guys, the guys that are ready to move up to the next level or two, they've got the new system going also.
Maximum impact, yeah. Exactly, yeah, exactly. And obviously a lot of levels thereof. And for the coaching members that are listening, it's the same lesson as it is in that structure, where, you know, you can have the goose, but unless you go pick the egg up, it doesn't do any good. You've got to take that next step in implementation, which is exactly what you said. Let's transition a little bit. A couple more, just maybe foundational questions, and then we certainly have a long list of nuts and bolts. How do I apply this stuff in my school? Topics today too. But I've always found this very interesting. But you knew Bruce Lee really well. You know, what was your impression of him, and what were your thoughts of his career and what he was able to accomplish for the industry?
Well, the first time I saw him was at June Reese Tournament in Washington, D.C., and then I saw him at the Internationals in California. And I got to have dinner with him on a couple occasions with June Reese at June Reese House, and just the three of us, and he was quite the entertainment. He had so much charisma. He had so much magnetism that when he walked into a room, everybody was drawn to him. He had, you know, he's one of those guys that would show you sleight of hand magic, or he would do some kind of trick, or he would do some kind of physical thing that you would be amazed at. You know, he had all kinds of little tricks and things and jokes and stories. And, I mean, he was constantly the center of attention. Very charismatic, but also very, I mean, he was so strong for his weight. I don't think there was anybody in the country in any sport that was stronger than him at his weight. And he was so fast. He would do some things with me to test my speed against his speed, and it would just make you seem like you were going in slow motion. And, you know, very impressive, but very, very friendly, very, you know, didn't have a big ego. You know, you might think that he was, you know, with all his success and everything, you know, kind of like a Chuck Norris. You know, Chuck Norris now is just the same Chuck Norris that I knew back in the 60s and 70s. And I was just with him a couple weeks ago when I was in Denver for the Karate Mile High Extravaganza, Black Belt Extravaganza. And we went to one of the World Combat fights and got a chance to talk with him in his room. And they're two similar styles. You know, Bruce Lee was the movie star first, but he was also a martial artist. Chuck Norris was a movie star, but also a martial artist. So it's amazing how both of them you know, developed a great following, and both of them were very worthy of it, because Bruce, you know, was the first one to really get martial arts, I think, recognized, you know, from the Green Hornet all the way into the Chinese movies, and of course Enter the Dragon when that broke, and that really catapulted Chuck Norris's his film career too. And that's what allowed him to continue on and do more movies after Bruce Lee passed away.
Absolutely. There was one more thing. You were involved in, of course, in the early days of the evolution of the martial arts into the professionalism that into the professional arena that it can be today. And there were a couple of interesting items I thought that the listeners might want to know about. You were involved in the introduction of safety equipment into the martial art, and also into the introduction of musical forms, different colored uniforms, that type of thing was unheard of, you know, when you were training to black belt. But then you were sort of instrumental or involved in at an intimate level the implementation of some of these things. You know, how did that come about, and what was the evolution process behind that, and
well,
how did that take the industry?
Let's talk about the safety equipment first. Actually, Mike Stone was the first one that started working on safety equipment that I know of. And June Rhee had heard Mike Stone talking about it, but didn't do anything about it until Pat Worley was fighting in a tournament here in Washington, D.C., called the All-American Taekwondo Championships. It was Kiwon Kim's tournament. And Pat Worley was fighting Mike Warren in the championship, and Mike Warren hit Pat Worley in the face with a reverse heel kick, and it caught him on the cheekbone and caved in his face. And I was in Pat's corner at the time, and when Pat, and this wasn't a full contact match, this was a point match, and Pat Worley went down but jumped right back up, so they didn't think he was hurt that bad. So they actually gave Mike Warren the point and the match. I think it was an overtime maybe at the time. And when Pat came walking back to the corner, I thought there was a giant bruise on his face because his face was dark. And I said, wow, that was a solid blow. It's already bruised. But as he got closer, I saw that it wasn't bruised. It was caved in. I mean, it crushed his whole cheekbone up under the eye socket. And it required extensive surgery and extensive rehabilitation before he was able to compete again. And because of that, you know, June Rhee said, well, if we had pads on our feet and hands, then we wouldn't have that problem. So June Rhee actually asked Mike Stone. Mike Stone had given up on it, so because June Rhee asked Mike Stone if he had any, and he hadn't developed it successful yet, so June Rhee asked him, would you mind if I did something like that? And Mike Stone said no. And so June Rhee started developing some hand and foot pads. From the hand and foot pads, of course, it just expanded to the shin guards, to the chest guards, and, you know, we already had a cup and a mouth guard, and that was about it. And then the headgear, and nowadays we even have a face shield. So, you know, we've really become more sophisticated, but, you know, safety in this country has been one of the primary concerns of all people in every sport, in everyday life. Seat belts now, it used to be just a lap belt and it wasn't even required, and not even any seat belts in the back seat, and Then it eventually became from the seat belts to the shoulder strap to the airbags to now we have, you know, airbags on the side, we have airbags in the steering wheel, airbags on the dash. And so where safety comes first, you know, we're trying to minimize any injuries and fatalities in automobiles. Well, that's the same thing we're trying to do in the martial arts, is to appeal to a larger audience and, you know, bring in the younger kids. And used to, when I started, you know, kids, if you were 12 years old, you were young in the sport. There weren't many kids. And then as it evolved, we started getting younger and younger. But one of the reasons for the expansion of the younger groups was the, I believe, the invention of the safety equipment. And, of course, without Jun Ri inventing that safety equipment, now, the only part that I had involved in doing and developing the safety equipment is that I was the guinea pig. He would make it. I would try it on as well as the other guys in D.C., and we would fight with it and where it would tear up. And then those were the stress points, and then they would reinforce it and then go from there and come up with a new version. And then so we helped along with some of the other guys, Pat Worley, along with the other guys that were here, got to be the guinea pigs for trying that. And, of course, then with me being in Washington, D.C., when they started using them in tournaments, the first tournament they ever used them was the Internationals. And in 1974, I won the grand championship at the Internationals wearing that safety equipment. Had I not won, I think wearing that safety equipment and winning the grand championship there, which was very hard to do, I was only the first person, or actually the second person since the beginning of the Internationals to ever win, being from outside of California. Everybody had only won it was always from California. And in 74, when I won it, I think it had a big impact on people wearing it from that point on. The next tournament after that, Mike Anderson in St. Louis, was actually the first tournament to make it mandatory. Ed Parker said originally he was going to make it mandatory, but a lot of the competitors complained, so he just said it was optional. Whereas Mike Anderson in St. Louis at the top 10 nationals, he told everybody you had to wear it or you couldn't compete. And he was the first one to really stick with the guns on that. And then the other tournaments started using it. Well, what happened is now that you had the foam padding, the fighters started hitting harder. So now guys were actually getting rocked harder than they were before, because before they would get hit only as an accident, but now they thought they had the pads. They thought you could hit them in the head. So then that's when Mike Anderson decided that, hey, with this equipment, now we could do a full contact. The guys are going harder and harder. You know, it went from a no contact to a semi-contact is what they called it. You had to touch to score, and you had to make contact to score to a full contact. So that was the evolution of full contact, and I still think to this day, had we not had the safety equipment, we would have never evolved to that full contact status, because back then, even when we started using the equipment and went full contact, people still thought people were going to get killed because it was so deadly. But they didn't realize that as you trained and you learned how to defend against the techniques and roll with it, that it was, you know, nothing more than boxing, where, you know, there have been some deaths in boxing, but there were more freak accidents than something that happened, just like there's been deaths in other sports. So it's something that through the evolution of the safety equipment did allow for full contact karate to become available and to be the sport where eventually now is the ultimate fighting. And you know, the first person to do the ultimate fighting was a guy from Hawaii named Tommy Lee, not the Tommy Lee from Maryland. But he was from Hawaii, and he started the first World Series. He called it the World Series of Martial Arts, and he did it in 1975 in Honolulu. And Benny the Jet won the first one. And they had fighters from all styles were invited to compete. You could be in judo, jiu-jitsu, kung fu, you know, Japanese, Korean, you could be Muay Thai, you could be Wushu, you could be Judo, you could be a boxer, a wrestler, a street fighter. They allow takedowns, throws, pins, submission holds. The only thing that they required, the only rules were that if you were going to strike with it, it had to be a padded area. So if you were going to punch with your fist, you had to have gloves on. If you were going to hit with your elbows, you had to have elbow pads. If you were going to strike with your knees, you had to have knee pads. If you were going to kick with your feet, you had to have a foot pad. So they allowed knees and elbows. They would allow you to throw your opponent to take him to the ground. And in 1975, the second event that he had, after Benny won, and the first one he didn't have any weight classes. And then he realized that he needed to change that. So in the second one, he ended up with weight classes. So he had a light, middle, light, heavy, and heavy. And I fought in the light heavyweight division and won the light heavyweight world championship in the World Series of Martial Arts. And Joe Lewis fought the heavyweight, and he was fighting for the championship for the final bout against a boxer from Hawaii named Teddy Lemos. And Teddy headbutted him in the second round and opened a cut over his eye, and they ended up stopping it because of the cut. So Joe didn't win it, but he definitely would have won it had they not stopped it, had he not gotten that headbutt with the cut. But that was really the first time they did the what's now considered the ultimate fighting. And he ran that for several years out of Hawaii, and was really the first what they called no holds barred, and back when they said no rules, even though even in UFC when they said no rules, there were rules. And even back then, there even though they said there was no rules, there was.
Absolutely, yeah. And you know, we've all seen the UFC evolve in the same way with, you know, the small gloves and that sort of thing. Now you can't wear, shoes if you're going to kick, and, you know, you can't kick a downed opponent and things like that. So you know, like you said, the safety consciousness of the, you know, the consumer and of the market is very important to take into consideration when you're structuring the program. I started martial arts in 1979, and I was very young, and they usually didn't take students as young as I was at the school, but I got lucky, and it was a friend of the family that was one of the instructors. And we literally had two sets of sparring gear for the entire school. You know, so when you were sparring, when you were up, you know, when it was your turn to spar, you would put on the big, you know, the gloves and the headgear that everyone else had used before you, you know. So, I mean, that was really the only level of sparring gear that we had when we started, you know, when I started in 79. But, you know, much the same experience. But anyway, let's transition a little bit into the next evolution. So, obviously, I think everybody understands, obviously, you're a very, very successful competitor at a level that there weren't many others at that level in your era, in that structure. You were definitely at the top of the heap. And then how you transitioned all that into operating a professional martial arts school. So tell us a little bit about how you balanced that in the early days and how that evolved through with the junior organization and how you balanced operating a professional school with your competition career.
Well, I've always been very competitive in everything I've done. So when it comes to the business side of it, I was also very competitive. And when we were running the schools, back then, in the early 70s, Nick Kokinas from EFC was actually a consultant for Jun Rhee and was helping him run his schools. And so I... Being a manager and an instructor at one of the schools, I eventually became the head instructor. I then eventually became the general manager, and then later I became the vice president. And then later I ran his whole safety equipment operation, too. From a marketing standpoint, I set up distributors all over the world. We set up distributors in Canada and Mexico and Hawaii. In all over Europe, we had distributors in almost every country in Europe and South America. And I set up that whole network of marketing the safety equipment throughout the world. And at that same time, I was competing. At that same time, I was training all of the instructors and training all the staff. Once I became you know, general manager, I was training all of the managers, and head instructor, I was training all the instructors, and then as vice president, I became more involved in that. And the whole time I was working with Nick Kokinas, and he was the consultant, and we would have a staff meeting every Friday that that he would head up, and I would implement a lot of his ideas and things that I was coming up with and things that I got a chance to try. So I would meet with Nick, and we would discuss things that we needed to cover in the meeting and do. And so that's how I eventually became running schools and expanding. We ended up with 12 schools with the June reorganization at the time, and running all those is quite an effort, especially when you're trying to train and compete and be a world champion at the same time, because in full contact, it required a lot more training, because we were fighting 12-round fights. And so your conditioning had to be, you couldn't miss a day of, you know, if you missed a day and didn't train, then you were going to be in trouble in a 12-round fight. So we would work out 3 to 5 hours a day just to keep our endurance and stamina up where we could compete on that, you know, that kind of national and international and world-class level. And then, of course, at the same time, trying to keep the schools going and keep everybody motivated. And part of that motivation was to keep them successful in their competitive career, because I found that our competitors, the ones who were really into it, became more involved in the martial arts and more wrapped up in it. And as they developed their technique, so they were able to share it with their students. So we used the same format back then. It's what I call our success formula of how to be a world champion in business, the same way to be a world champion in fighting. And it just talks with discipline and training going through the same phases you would, like you'd do your bag work and road work and your sparring and your pad work and your jump rope and your stretching and your endurance training, those kind of things, along with running a business. You have to learn all phases and wear all different hats, so you know how to teach the intro, you know how to answer the phone, you know how to do the upgrades, you know how to teach the classes. And at the same time, you then have to know how to teach somebody else those things. So those are the different phases of the business, and then you have to know how to market it. You have to know, you know, how to do the advertising, and we did a lot of TV advertising back then. So, you know, getting into the TV advertising, as well as newspaper and magazines and stuff like that, and flyers and, you know, buddy referrals. I mean, all that stuff was going on back then. I mean, those are the things that we did, and those are the things that we taught everybody. We taught everybody so well that everybody who was in our organization back then is still running schools today. The Worley brothers are there. Steve Oliver's are there, and you know, we've had a number of people that came up through that June reorganization that moved on to their own area, and you know, as well as I did. And part of that evolution was kind of coming back into the organization with Steve Oliver, because you know, Steve back then, you know, when he left to do Mile High and developed it, you know, later down the road, we were still sharing ideas. He was giving me ideas, I was giving him ideas, and so he was still expanding his business all the way up until he became what I call the franchisor. You know, I mean, he was the one who started the whole national franchising thing, and a couple of people have tried it in the past, but nobody has come into a franchise system with the type of technique and the knowledge that he brings to the field, because he's got the answer for the classroom to develop a great student and the retention. But he's also got the other part of it, which is the business side of it, of the marketing. He's also got the side of the office to convert those students that are staying in the classroom into a retention and an upgrade and a renewal, so you expand the growth of the school through retention, through renewals and upgrades. And
absolutely.
Still bringing new people in through the marketing, because most people go out of business for two reasons. They don't get enough new students in, or they don't upgrade enough students because too many people are dropping out. So as simple as it seems, there is many things that Stephen has learned through the years, as I, that through trial and error of learning what worked and what didn't work. And the thing was, Steve was never satisfied with the results. He always wanted to reach higher levels and higher goals. And so, you know, he's what I call the world champion of the marketing and the world champion of developing new school systems, because he has developed a system that allows somebody that doesn't have much experience in the martial arts, that is a black belt, but is somebody that maybe is not even a black belt. And, you know, somebody says, well, how can somebody run a school if they're not a black belt? Well, that doesn't mean they're teaching class, but they can run the office. That doesn't mean they don't have a knowledge of the system. You know, it means that to have a successful school, you have to wear more than one hat, or you have to have somebody else wearing the other hat. So if you don't have somebody good in the classroom, and you don't have somebody good in the office, and you don't have somebody good that's marketing it, then you're going to have problems somewhere. All three of those things have to be in balance. And that's what he's developed, a system that is based on a system of integration of plug and play, where it accelerates the learning process. To take somebody and really teach them all that stuff takes a long time. I've developed staff, but it's years to develop people like that. With his plug-and-play system, all they have to do is hand somebody a videotape. All they have to do is plug it in and explain it to them and show it to them, let them listen to it, let them see it, let them read it, and let them get an email, let them get a printed material or a booklet in the mail, and now those systems drive the retention, those systems drive the upgrades, those systems drive the marketing. So it takes care of those three phases of the business that most people rack their brain. And, you know, it floors me when I see somebody who is a great martial artist running a school and not making any money. It kills me. When I see a guy who's not a very good martial artist is making a lot of money with a good classroom, with a good office, but the instructor doesn't have to be a world champion. Because you're a world champion doesn't make you a great instructor. And that's what a lot of people forget. Now, Bill Wallace is a great instructor. Joe Lewis is a great instructor. But not everyone is. There's a lot of guys out there that are great competitors. I've known a bunch of great competitors are lousy at running schools. I've known other guys that weren't that good a competitor, but they were great teachers. And, you know, it's kind of like the coaches in the NFL. Some of the best coaches, they weren't great football players. They had a great mind for football. So some of our best teachers are the ones who have a great mind for getting that message and that technique across the correct way. That's where Stephen and I joined forces, and why I became part of the Mile High organization is because Steve wanted my expertise in the classroom and my experience in training staff and training instructors to upgrade their techniques, to upgrade their knowledge in the classroom, to give the students an opportunity, to give the instructors an opportunity to upgrade what goes on in the classroom. Because Steve is never satisfied with the product. He wants to constantly be upgrading. So that's why he brought me in, because my knowledge in the field, and as long as I've been in it, the reason I joined up with him is because his knowledge in the marketing, his knowledge in putting a system together that I knew would be successful for anybody. And he has proved it by taking people from scratch, taking a gold belt, and training them in the office, husband and wife, to eventually getting their black belt and have an instructor in the classroom with them, and developing great students, and developing high grosses in the school. More higher grosses than some of the schools who have some very good black belts as the program directors or managers, as well as the classroom. So because they didn't know any better, because they didn't have the experience of some of these other people, they followed Steve's system blindly, and they were unprejudiced. And that's the problem with so many school owners, is they think they have the right system. So when you tell them how to do it, by the time it gets to the finished product that they use, it's so watered down that it doesn't work. Whereas if they would just take it and run with it exactly the way it is, the way he said it to do it, they're going to be successful. So
yeah,
they end up messing it up because they're trying to revise it.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
No, absolutely. It's a difference between opinion and result. And if you have a predisposed opinion about something, that doesn't necessarily reflect what's accurate or what reality is. But if you test and you take the results of an activity, that tells you what reality really is. So if you're the best, if you're in your own mind, you're the best instructor in the world, yet you've got three students in your school, then you're probably not the best instructor in the world, right? I mean, something is in the way. There's a perception of the value of your services that isn't commensurate with what you perceive your value to be. So it's very illuminating to, like you said, take someone that's, you know, unmolded clay, show them what the system is, and just basically hand it to them, and have them have no preconceptions about what should work or what shouldn't work, and lo and behold, it works. Because it's based on what we know works. It's based on systems that are tested and that have given results for given activity. So if you're banging your head against the wall and you're saying, okay, I can't figure out why this doesn't work, well, the reason is, you know, you haven't tested it appropriately. And all of these systems that you're talking about have been tested, and they're tried and true, and they work. You just have to implement them the right way. And that's exactly what you said. And in addition to that, what you said is, you know, the guy that's the world champion martial artist doesn't necessarily always make the best instructor, or doesn't necessarily always make the best business owner. They certainly can, but it's not a given, because they're completely separate skill sets. I mean, it doesn't take long consulting with martial arts schools and speaking to owners and speaking to different types of martial artists to figure out that, you know, the guy that's really, really, really good at judo might not be a great wushu stylist, right? His body might not be made up that way. He might have, you know, a low center of gravity and very, you know, thick legs or something like that. Well, that's not going to do a lot of good over in the wushu field, where it's much more applicable to be, you know, thin and tall and be able to do the flippy things, right?
Yeah.
Well, it's the same as a world champion martial artist being a school owner. Sometimes the two skill sets aren't complementary to each other. Sometimes they're not the same thing. And that's what you said is you have the ability now in this structured system to take someone that's a very talented instructor and partner them or put them with someone who's a good business operator that can operate the marketing and sales systems, so that the teacher can teach and that the business owner can operate the business, and they can be very, very, very successful with each other, which is exactly right. You know, I think that's extremely valuable. Let's transition a little bit into you ran a small chain of schools in Virginia, and I'd been to your schools and have extremely high quality students up there for a long, long time. And tell us a little bit about the evolution of that. If, as you moved into being a professional martial artist as a school owner and as an instructor, what did you find was different than when you were being just a competitor or operating schools for, you know, Junri, for example? What was the, you know, the breakthrough or the aha that you had to go through to be able to operate those schools very successfully and move forward with that part of your career?
Well, I would say, you know, step one, if you're going to have a successful program, you have to make sure that you're developing quality students. Now, one of the problems people run into when they're trying to develop quality students is that it's hard to make somebody better than they want to be. So I call that force feeding. You cannot force feed a student, but what you can do is make them want to learn more, to motivate them to want to be better, and then to inspire them to reach higher goals by setting their standard higher themselves. When you go into a classroom and you teach a hard class, I can go in and in 10 or 15 minutes, I can burn out everybody in the class. Maybe there's one or two people that can hang, but that doesn't teach anybody anything. All that teaches them is that you can work them out and you can make them tired. Big deal. What you have to do is make them want to be better. You have to motivate them to practice. You have to motivate them to pay attention to details. If you want to be a good martial artist, you have to have good basics. It starts with the basics. In the Mile High organization, they have a basic program. This is where they keep the students and teach them just the basics until they're ready to move in to a black belt program or into a leadership program. One of the things that Master Oliver has me doing as the National Director of Training is to go in and help the instructors and find the ways to motivate these students to want to be better. We have a homework system where students get rewarded for practicing at home. We have another system of homework when they get to be a brown belt. It's required that they practice at home, and they have to keep track of it on their homework card. And they have to bring that card in to show that they've been practicing. Those kind of things, along with inspiring the students in making sure. Now, I tell the instructors, you don't have to be a great black belt to produce a great student. But you have to have a great eye for the quality of a student. In other words, you have to be able to correct their details. If their details are not correct, you know, in stances, you know, foot positions, body posture, you know, correct hand positions, all those little things, if you don't have the eye to correct it, the students aren't going to correct it. So you have to call their attention to it. But, you know, even correcting a student is an art because nobody likes to be told they're doing something wrong. They like to be praised for what they're doing. So what I teach our instructors is whenever you're going to correct somebody, first give them some praise, follow that with some constructive criticism that's based on encouragement, on what they need to work on. You know, your sidekick is great. You've got one of the best sidekicks in the class, but if you could improve your foot position, it's going to be even better. Now, I know you can do it because you're one of my top students. So you see how I sandwich positive with the correction back with another positive. I call that the sandwich of knowledge. That's the food that you've got to give each student if you want them to nourish and grow. If you don't give them that, they won't get better. They will. Now, some students learn by watching. And there's three areas of learning. People learn by watching. People learn by repetition of doing. Or you have to physically correct them yourself. If somebody watches, you'll see some kids who pick it up very quickly because the instructor demonstrates it, and they can mimic it almost exactly, but very few. The next type of person is you have to explain to them where it makes sense to them. And then if they keep doing it and you keep correcting those little details, they eventually get it. But then you've got the third type of person is a person who cannot get it. They don't have the coordination or they don't have the eye for it themselves to even know they're making that mistake. So they keep making the same mistake over and over. Well, instructors get tired of correcting them. So what I found, the way to correct that type of student, and that type of student, and it's usually probably about 50% of them fall in that category, is you have to physically move their hand into the correct position so they can feel, they get that muscle memory of exactly where it's supposed to go and how it feels. Move them through it, guiding it with your hands a couple times. Let them try it again. Guide it again. That little positive feedback and guiding them is what helps them find that muscle memory that helps them correct those details. That's how you make a great student. Those are the things that make great martial artists. It's not the secret technique that you teach them. It's the good basics and the attention to detail that makes them a great student. And the personal attention, because when you are training a student, if you take a personal interest in making that student be the best he can be and motivating and inspire him to want to be better, then that student is going to be happy. That student's not going to drop out. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, the praise correct phrase technique for on the floor instruction is vital. I mean, it's actually something that, unfortunately, you know, with my recent experience with them, I now have the opportunity to talk to literally thousands of martial arts schools, and I have been speaking to hundreds over the last, you know, 10 weeks, maybe 12 weeks, and I don't think anybody on the call qualifies because you're already more of an advanced thinker than the people I talk to on a day-to-day basis. But you would be shocked at how many are still thinking that the way to do a student's brain is through their backside and just think that kicking their butt is the best way to do it, right? Whereas, you know, praise correct praise is a technique that has, you know, worked in elementary school education forever, right? I mean, for, you know, for 50 years. And it's something that is a way to make a different neurologic response from a student. You're conditioning them to accept instruction rather than to resist it.
The problem is people think that practice makes perfect.
Yes.
Practice doesn't make perfect. Perfect practice makes perfect. So if they keep doing it incorrectly, they're just building the muscle memory for doing it wrong. Now, the advantage of practicing it wrong, if there is advantage, is that, yes, they can practice at home. If they do it wrong, it doesn't matter because you're going to correct it when they come to the school. And the at-home practice is to build the strength, to build the speed, to build the flexibility, to build the balance in the student. Because what they do in class, if they can do something at home, it can accelerate that part of their development. Because for a student to become a good martial artist, they have to develop strength, coordination, balance, reflexes. They have to have speed, timing, distance. These are things that can be learned. But if they're doing all of their technique incorrectly, they're going to limit their knowledge in the field and their performance. And this is how, through our system, we've been able to develop some of the top form competitors in the country. You know, coming up through our system, you know, the John Chung and the Charlie Lees and, you know, Elsa Cadero. And we've always had some of the top form competitors. And it all goes back to, you know, our first big national forms competitor, Pat Worley. He was the first one in the Junry system to win on a national level in forms. And after him followed, a John Chung and a Charlie Lee and Michael Dietrich. And, you know, we had people like that were great in forms. And Elsa Cadero on the female side and Regina Gonzalez, and you know, we had people like that. And there's other Junry systems around the country that have also formed people in the country. And that's how we were able to develop that system. So our system, we've developed some of the top form competitors in the country. We've developed a lot of the national and world point fighting. We've developed national and world champions in the full contact arena. The system of instruction for these students expands the whole spectrum. It incorporates those phases of. So for somebody to say, oh, the Mile High organization has such great students, that's how. Track record of doing that through the junior, and that's where Steve came up through. I was, and that's where I trained. That's why I'm with the Mile High now. So, you know, when a school wants to convert my system, you know, sometimes they're a little, how do I lose my identity? How do I keep my identity? Well, the thing about our system is we are expanding our knowledge in the field. We are taking martial arts to a whole new level. We are taking all systems to become part of high. Because to be a high belt, we want all of our instructors and other systems. Because there is enough to learn from every martial arts system. Judo, whether it's jiu-jitsu, whether it's kung fu, whether it's Japanese, whether it's a weapon system, whether it's form-based, sparring-based, we're going to take all systems, they're going to be incorporated in belt training. See, we're not concerned about under black belt is just basics, is where it's at. And the problem around the country, at first degree, students thought there was to learn, and they dropped out. Mile High system, they stay on to the higher level because we have an advanced curriculum that takes the higher fifth and sixth degree levels. Curriculum that they learn every 2 and 3 months, curriculum that's rotating around, that they're learning new systems. So when somebody comes into our system, some of the top jiu-jitsu guys now in our system, and they are the higher levels of that in our black belt training. Come in that are great in our knees. We have guys who with nunchucks or a great bow staff or a great this. So that's how the Mile High system, you know, gets incorporated. You know, Doug Mooney in Maryland, you know, his background is in, and he came into our system and incorporated our system. So, you know, he was able to incorporate a jiu-jitsu school who is in the organization. We have these different schools, you know, from all systems that were able to do our system, convert it, not lose their identity, and upgrade the business end with their retention, upgrade student morale, upgrade quality of the school, appearance-wise, professionally run. And now make, because when we train our students, it's not punching. Yes, that's important, but the iceberg. What we want is personal development. We want these kids to be great citizens. We want them to be active, and we want them to be a positive influence in our society. Mile High system, we're in the child development business. So we're not only going to make them great martial artists, we're going to make them, they're going to be great students in school, great business people when they get out of school. You know, when they get their college degree, they're going to be successful in everything they do because we are their success through our system. And that's what the Mile High system is about. Successful kids is building success through martial arts training. Not giving them martial arts to go, you know, and kill somebody or wipe somebody out or to defend themselves. They can do it. But people have to use that in the street. Not. So if that's the only purpose of the training, a lot. See, so that's why organization, the training that they do for the system emphasizes the activity and the training that we do on that side of it to knowledge and their motivation. Amazing. Anybody who sees it is impressed.
Absolutely.
And that's why I'm with Mile High, because it encompasses. Master
yep.
Oliver has looked into the crystal ball and he sees what to pay for. And if it's a fun, they'll go to the Y and pay $40. But if it's personal development, education, they will pay big bucks. Look when they go to private schools. Everybody goes. Well, it's already paid for with your tax dollars, but there's a most of the private schools. And most of the private schools in the smaller areas in the country are anywhere to $20,000 a year. Elementary school. There's colleges that don't, but people are paying it because they want their children to have that type of benefit of the knowledge of their. Well, when these same parents come in and they see the and how we can educate mind through positive reinforcement, positive self-image, through confidence, through respect, it takes it to a whole. That's why the parents in the Mile High organization rave. The deal that they got, $150 or $400 a month for a car, who would pay that? Unless it's worth it. Why should you buy a Mercedes or a BMW for $100,000? You can go buy a Hyundai for $8,000 because it's worth it. Engineering because of the quality. Because it is a product that has customers rave reviews from the repeat buyers. That's our karate system. We have rave reviews. We have repeat buyers. Buyers are the people who came in on the trial program and upgraded and renewed their program to the black belt or the master or the leadership program. And they see the value in it, then they don't buy. Does that make sense?
No. In fact, I think we're going to run out of time really rapidly here.
Okay.
Really appreciate your time today. Let me quote things that you just said that are extremely important. Number one is martial arts school owners in the market think that they're connect between a successful business and a quality student. In our case, they're one and the same. You can't have one without the other. Very important for everybody to understand. It's not a trade-off. It's not a
compromise. Physical. We have
That's
to
right.
have good physical students, but also.
That's right. That's right. The multifacets. Exactly. And that's exactly right. And for us, the measure of the result is the quality of the black. And if the black belt at the end of the pipeline is incapable or not technically as skilled as we want them to be, then, and frankly, that just doesn't happen. Testing cycles and requirements are that, you know, we have 8 and 9 year old students earning a black belt, frankly, doing more than most styles even have from first through seventh degree black belts.
All somebody has to do is attend one of the black belt extravaganzas, and they see what those people are their training, and nobody would ever question. All they have to do is see it. And the thing is, we have it on video because we tape those, and we have the testimonials from the parents and the students who were there, who were on doing it on a regular basis. So we have proof of the product.
Yeah. Not opinion. It's tested, and it's... But, you know, thank you so much, Master Smith. I questions here for you. I thought that we would have time to get to, but the 90 minutes is, and I think our beep is going to tell us in a minute that it'll cut us off. Thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it. Really appreciate it. And we will, you know, have an opportunity to ask questions maybe at a future date.
And if anybody has any that they would like to ask, you know, direct to the website. And we'll be glad to, you know, when I'm convention or when you get to see me at any events or organization, don't hesitate to, and I'll be able to elaborate a little bit for you.
Absolutely, and feel free to email as well. I'm, but my email address is Toby Milroy, TobyMilroy at NAPMA.com, NAPM. And we'll get you you know any answers, any questions. Okay. Thank you so much, Master Smith. Thank you for your time.
Toby. Okay.